Sponsorship of this KQED podcast is provided by California College of the Arts, offering extension courses focused on design, fine arts, and digital technology. Campuses in Rock Ridge, Oakland, and Potrero Hill in San Francisco. cca.edu/extension.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org. And URS, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical support to public agencies and private companies. URS.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, under pressure from a federal court, Governor Brown explains how he'll reduce the inmate population. His own corrections chief calls the plan ugly. Plus, taking their cue from Stanford, the University of California tries turning research into cash.
We went from the university's sort of public space to now private company space. Any cool wind you feel is the breath of capitalism blowing through the university.
Also in remote parts of Riverside County, substandard housing for migrant farm workers.
We're not in Cuba here. We're not in El Salvador. We're not in Africa, right? We're in one of the richest countries, if not the richest country in the world.
It's the California Report. The first week of May is looking more like June or even July in California. An early start to fire season had thousands of people fleeing their homes as fire crews from Sonoma to Riverside battled wildfires across the state. But in Sacramento, Governor Jerry Brown has been consumed by a political hotspot, a midnight Thursday deadline to tell a federal court how he's going to reduce prison crowding. The governor is resisting, says the inmate population has already been significantly reduced, but the court says that's not good enough. And so, at the last minute, a defiant Governor Brown gave the court his plan, which includes early release of older and frail inmates, even using some inmates with violent pasts to fight forest fires. Friday morning, Corrections Secretary Jeffrey Beard made it clear the administration is none too happy with its own plan.
Look, we did the best we could do for the people of California and to protect the public safety. And, you know, that's all I can say. We can't do any more without creating huge problems for the counties, without creating huge problems for this historic realignment that occurred, and without creating huge problems for the public safety. And we just won't do that.
Joining us now to talk about it is Michael Montgomery, a reporter with KQED and the Center for Investigative Reporting. Michael, first of all, what's at the heart of this issue?
Well, you know, Scott, we've been here a number of times talking about this issue, which really is about whether or not the state is providing adequate mental and medical health care for inmates. These cases go back, one case goes back to 1990. The other case is from 2001. The state has been battling with the courts over this for years. We had the U.S. Supreme Court step in 2 years ago and affirm a lower court decision. And it really boils down to this. The courts have determined that the state cannot deliver adequate health care to inmates unless the population comes down to a certain point. And that level, as the courts have said, is about 110,000 inmates.
And the governor has said, look, we've already reduced the inmate population. And so what is it? He's saying we're running out of good options here?
So the governor has said, as has Secretary Beard, that essentially this cap has become arbitrary. The governor in January pronounced the California prison health care system among the best in the nation, if not the world. And they're saying, isn't that the aim of this whole process, to deliver adequate health care and mental health care? So the governor and the Department of Corrections are saying there is no constitutional problem here anymore.
So obviously, Michael, the governor's not happy. The courts aren't happy. Is anyone satisfied with the direction that the administration's going here?
Well, certainly, Scott, even before the governor's plan was announced, on Thursday, we had protests by advocacy groups who were basically saying the governor isn't going nearly far enough here. One person we heard from was Laura Magnani.
We're really disappointed that the Brown administration seems to be leaning toward building more or creating more space rather than really addressing the sentencing issues that could be addressed, the conditions that could be addressed, the many ways that we could be reducing the population.
So, Michael Montgomery, all the things the governor outlined in the plan they gave to the court, can the administration do these things unilaterally, or does it need approval from somebody?
No. Many of these elements need to go to the legislature. And the governor himself says he doesn't support this plan. He's not going to go to bat for it.
Well, he says it could jeopardize public safety.
Indeed. He says, the governor says, that this could put dangerous felons on the streets early, essentially early release. Other things they're talking about, as you mentioned, putting higher-risk inmates in fire camps, slowing the rate of inmates coming from out-of-state facilities, perhaps leasing beds from jails, diverting more felons to jails. Again, the governor has said that that could put his whole realignment plan under pressure.
Well, and county jails are already bulging, aren't they, in many places?
Well, they are, and there have been efforts by some lawmakers to tweak the realignment law to put more felons who are currently in jails back in state lockups, which would, again, increase the prison population.
So complicating all this is this fatal fungal disease that broke out in a couple of prisons in the Central Valley. So what does that do? Because now there's another 3,000 or so inmates that have to be moved somewhere.
Correct. The health receiver, Clark Kelso, has ordered the state to move the most vulnerable inmates out of these facilities. The state is refusing to do so. So yet another court order, yet another confrontation.
And we should say several dozen have died, right?
Three dozen have died since inmates have died of this fungal disease since 2006. I asked Rebecca Evanson, she's a plaintiff's attorney with the prison law office, about this.
In any prison system, you need to leave room for this kind of emergency situation and also non-emergency situations where you have new prisoners coming into the system. You need to have a place to put people that's safe and that doesn't unreasonably endanger their lives.
And Michael, doesn't the outbreak of this valley fever undermine the state's case that healthcare conditions are so much better?
Well, it questions whether they can address a sort of an emergency situation like this. Now, that doesn't necessarily fall into the court order of providing constitutionally mandated health care. But as Rebecca Evanson says, and any prison administrator will tell you this, you need excess capacity. You need empty beds so you can move people around. What the state is essentially saying is that they are really running right to the edge of capacity, meaning they can't shift hundreds or thousands of inmates around because they're full.
And quickly, Michael, the governor is promising to appeal this up to the Supreme Court, even though the court has already said you've got to get this done.
The U.S. Supreme Court 2 years ago affirmed the lower court's ruling in this case and essentially ordered the state to meet this population cap. And essentially what that means is losing another 9,000 inmates by the end of the year. Now, the irony here is, by the state's own admission, under this plan that's just been released, they won't even meet that target. So where does this take us? Probably back to the courts.
So, Michael, just the latest chapter in a very long story. That's Michael Montgomery, reporter with KQED and the Center for Investigative Reporting. Michael, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Scott.
There's an old joke that Stanford is really just a startup incubator with a football team. Easy to understand with companies like Google and Yahoo getting their start on campus. But it's not just MBAs who are blurring the lines between industry and academia. Schools focusing on science are now scrambling to help students turn their lab work into the next big biotech company. UC San Francisco is among the institutions looking to compete, as Sam Harnett reports.
Matthew Spindler came to UCSF because he wanted to be a scientist, to research, publish, and eventually teach. Then he took a few classes offered by UCSF's Entrepreneurship Center, and now he's got a new plan, to combine his love for science with business.
The company that we're starting is more focused on personalized genomics for patients that are suffering from diabetic disease.
Spindler's startup is based on an app he's developing that'll help diabetics track their health and make lifestyle choices. This is not the traditional science research route. That you can find a few floors up at Professor Peter Walter's cell biology lab.
We are starting from a basis of discovery. Yeah, I want to understand how cells work. I really love the process of figuring out, well, how the cell is more than a bag of chemicals.
Walter characterizes his accomplished career as walking the serendipitous path of discovery. Spindler probably shouldn't use that line with investors. He's better off emulating his teacher, Stephanie Maris. She directs the Entrepreneurship Center and plans to expand it with a grant from the National Science Foundation.
The goal is to make us the number one entrepreneurship center in healthcare and life sciences in the United States.
That won't be easy. MIT, Purdue, and other universities already have entrepreneurship centers of their own. Scott Morrison is a biotech analyst at Ernst & Young. He says UCSF does have one big advantage: location. It's surrounded by venture capitalists and big pharmaceutical companies.
They've tried to accumulate all the stakeholders in the sector that can help young entrepreneurs really evaluate what they have.
Since the biotech bubble burst again in 2007, Morrison says the industry has become much more cautious in how it evaluates startups.
The bar today for forming a new company is much higher than it's ever been before.
And universities make perfect proving grounds. The science is cutting edge, the academic body can vet ideas, and there's even cheap, skilled labor with all the students and postdocs around. That's why Morrison says companies are investing in schools more than ever. UCSF has an $85 million partnership with Pfizer and more than 15 research collaborations with Genentech.
That's the future of the industry.
Once students have created a business plan at UCSF's Entrepreneurship Center, they can test out the science at QB3. The state-sponsored program provides private lab space for fledgling companies at Berkeley, Santa Cruz, and UCSF. Douglas Crawford is the associate director.
We went from the university's sort of public space to now private company space. Any cool wind you feel is the breath of capitalism blowing through the university.
Here, UCSF spin-out companies have everything they need. They've got industrial refrigerators to store test samples, giant agitators to mix chemical compounds, and access to some serious equipment. A DNA sequencer, $500,000 microscopes, even a 3D printer. Charles Noble is a former postdoc at UCSF. He's here working with a team on a high-tech drug delivery system.
We use nanoparticles to encapsulate drugs and make them go to specific locations in your body. So we try to capitalize on that.
Noble and his team hope UCSF's business connections will help them find an industry partner and launch a final product.
We would like to do all the early testing, the discovery stage, but then we'd like to have the large pharmaceutical company take on when we're at some degree of clinical trials.
This whole focus on product-driven research may resonate with investors, but it's a disturbing trend for Professor Peter Walter. The cell biologist says our greatest advancements have come from basic research, things like penicillin and x-rays. They weren't discovered by some postdoc trying to make a buck with a smartphone app.
I think it would be very useful to put a lot of emphasis on promoting basic discovery and to make sure that the postdocs remember why they got into this business in the first place.
But for many new graduate students now, one of the reasons they're getting into the life science business is business. For the California Report, I'm Sam Harnett.
Today, we're launching a series called Graduation Day. Budding reporters from the USC Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism were assigned to profile high school students, counting down the days until graduation. The result? Intimate stories that dig into the lives of young Californians at different levels of academic achievement, from diverse backgrounds and faiths, all on the brink of adulthood, all struggling to make tough choices. We begin the series in South LA and meet a teenager who wants a better life for foster kids, starting with herself. Erin Schrank reports.
Say good morning.
It's a Tuesday morning, and like most mornings, Kariah Welch is running late. She's getting three little boys ready for school.
Wash your face and brush your teeth, and then you could go eat.
I have to wake up very early in the morning. I have to pick out three outfits and comb three full heads of hair and make three meals a day.
Milk. Milk. Milk.
Then the process starts again with me. That's why most of the time I'm late for school if I'm not up early enough. And then when I come home, it's the same.
I put on my shirt.
I know. I do everything over and put them to bed.
It sounds like a lot of work, and it is. Kariah is 17 years old. She and three of her little brothers are living in a foster home in South Los Angeles. She's not just their big sister, but their protector. She has four brothers altogether.
We kind of have the same name. My name is Kariah, and then there's Cordell Jr., and then there's Cortland, Cortez, and Corian. and therefore 3, 2, and 1 back to back.
You talk to that rice car.
They're really good kids. Those are my babies.
Kariah is a senior at a South LA high school. It's the 6th one she's been to, thanks to her bouncing around in the foster care system with her brothers. She's applied to more than 70 universities and already has her heart set on a master's degree and law school. She wants to go into politics and work to help foster kids, but first, she needs to decide on a college.
So what is your plan? What do you plan to do when you finish?
My name is Renisha Scott, and I'm the high school counselor at Fauché Learning Center for all high school students, last names M through Z. Generally, Kariah's here every day, actually.
She's worried about moving to another state and leaving her brothers behind.
Her heart is not going to allow her to leave if she doesn't feel like they're secure.
When I'm gone and I'm across the country, I mean, being across the city hurts. Being across the country is going to hurt more.
Kariah wasn't always a foster kid. Her mother hasn't been around since she can remember, but she and her brothers lived with their father until 2 years ago. After a domestic dispute between her dad and the boy's mother, the kids were separated, sent to foster homes all over Los Angeles.
I would think every day, like, are they eating okay? Are they bathing every day? Can they sleep at night? Like, because I wasn't sleeping at night. Are they sleeping at night? Like, sometimes I thought in my head, like, how can my mom not feel like this when I'm away? How does a mother not feel this?
Kariah fought to get her family back together. She spent a lot of time on the phone with the Department of Children and Family Services and her brother's lawyers.
Every day, they got a call from me. I was bugging them.
After months of calling, Kariah got herself and three of her brothers into a foster home with a family friend. The fourth brother went to Kariah's grandmother. It's not a perfect situation, but the kids are pretty much together. Every Sunday, they spend the day at their grandmother's, hanging out and playing video games. Their dad, Cordell Welch, is allowed a supervised visit.
Once you get on Gundam style, we ready.
He sits off to the side chuckling and bouncing baby Corian on his knee. He's glad Kariah can be a role model for his younger kids and look out for them.
I really need her to be that right now for me because of the separation. It's real important to me, and it's important that she does it, you know, a good job at it too, because that's like my other younger kids' future.
Kariah's social worker recently told her that if she wanted, she could move back with her dad. But her brothers couldn't, so Kariah said no.
I used to complain all the time that I wanted to go home and that I wanted them to go home. But it's like, if they're not there, how is it a home?
Another reason to stay in the system? If she leaves, she'll lose eligibility for all sorts of scholarships and grants given to foster kids. And she knows they can help her more than her dad can. Her dad knows this, too.
So she needs all the head starts she can get. So, yes, I would definitely support her using all the advantages she can get.
Hi, June. How was your day? Is there any mail for me?
After a long day at school, Kariah rifles through the mail before getting the boys ready for bed. She's been accepted to about 20 colleges, mostly out of state. Many of her top choices closer to home rejected her. She plops her three little brothers into the bathtub.
Get in. Oh, you need help.
There's a lot on her mind.
If I have to go out of the state, I'm going to have to do it, and I'm going to do it. But they're going to be torn.
So is Kariah.
Okay, bedtime.
Her family will all be there in mid-June to watch her graduate, and they'll be rooting for her to stay in California. She's not sure what she'll do. For her, college is the first step toward a career helping children in need. And she hopes she can take it without hurting the children who might need her the most.
Good night.
Good night.
For the California Report, I'm Aaron Schrank in Los Angeles.
That story was produced in collaboration with the USC Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. Next week, our Graduation Day series continues with a profile of a young man who has to choose between two very separate callings, playing basketball and being a Mormon missionary. There was a ribbon cutting in the Coachella Valley east of Palm Springs this week, a new housing complex to replace a dilapidated mobile home park. That 80-unit development is welcome news, but much more is needed. The region is rich in agricultural bounty, but the farm workers there, many of them immigrants, often live in substandard mobile home parks. Reporter Lisa Morehouse visited a few of them to learn about the challenges of affordable housing in the region and what the future may hold.
It's before 7 a.m., and demolition teams move up and down the dirt roads of a mobile home park called Duraville. Bulldozers tear down empty units to make sure that no one else can move in.
The one thing I'm not going to miss is the muddy floors, like the muddy dirt.
20-year-old Adrian Pena spent much of his childhood in Duraville, which, at its height, housed as many as 4,000 people. It became notorious for its bad conditions. A substandard electrical system caused major fires, and half-century-old mobile homes leaked wind and rain. Still, like other residents, Pena is attached to Duraville.
Because I know I'll always end up calling this place my home, no matter what.
In 2009, a Riverside County judge ordered Duraville closed. And after years of litigation and bureaucratic holdups, it's now happening. But only when residents secure alternative housing. 5 miles away sits Mountain View Estates, where 10 new mobile homes get moved in each week. It cost $26 million to build, and much of that came from California's now-defunct Redevelopment Agency. This park is only for former Duraville residents, and it boasts pristine landscaping, vigilant security, and a park where kids play soccer after school.
I have a big kitchen, I have my own room, and my baby has his own room.
Across the street from the park, field worker Liliana Mendoza beams as she shows off the home she shares with her husband, son, and sister.
I'm better here.
Why?
I'm happy.
It costs more to live here than in Duraville, but Mendoza says it's worth it. She says she thinks she knows why few people, especially urbanites, are concerned about affordable housing for farm workers like her.
They don't look for the farmers over here. Most of the people on the city doesn't know that there's a place over here. There's people living in a bad condition over here.
Mendoza knows she's one of the lucky ones.
The concern for us in the Eastern Coachella Valley is that people believe that the fight might be over, or that this was the last big hurdle for Eastern Coachella Valley housing.
Sitting at a computer with a Google Earth image of Duraville on the screen, immigrant rights attorney Megan Beeman zooms out to show the sheer magnitude of mobile home parks here.
Less than a mile from Duraville, we can see that there are a number of other mobile home parks that look very similar, including one that's actually bigger than Duraville.
Zooming further, you see a checkerboard of farmland and open desert and hundreds of mobile home parks. On some parks, there are just a handful of mobile homes. Others house hundreds. Some, like Duraville, are on tribal land. Other property owners are farmers or former farm workers. Some parks meet all of Riverside County's health and safety codes. More than 100 don't have all the required permits. Plenty of these function well, but others have sketchy wiring or borderline septic systems that leak.
This is the United States of America.
Assembly member Victor Manuel Perez grew up in this valley.
We're not in Cuba here. We're not in El Salvador. We're not in Africa, right? We're in one of the richest countries, if not the richest country in the world.
He's shepherded bills through the state's legislature to improve living conditions in mobile home parks.
I know that there are limited resources. I get that. But I just find it interesting that disproportionately, it's our working poor and folks of color that are impacted negatively.
Ideally, substandard parks like Duraville would be replaced by more permanent and regulated housing, like Mountain View Estates or affordable apartments and houses. Over the years, the county and organizations like the Coachella Valley Housing Coalition built thousands of units. But a major funding source, the redevelopment agency, is gone, and there are still thousands of families on waiting lists. So many housing advocates say, be realistic. Funnel resources into rehabilitating mobile home parks where people already live, like a park called Valenzuela. Tucked between two major roads in the middle of farmland, 11 families form a close-knit community. On January 9th, their power went out. In mid-March, when I visit, residents use generators a few hours a day to power stoves for cooking and lights for the kids to do homework. With her two-year-old in tow, Eva Zamora walks me past a nest of extension cords connected to a generator shared by three mobile homes. She opens her refrigerator to show me its empty shelves.
Here you can see I have nothing in my refrigerator, not even milk for my kids, because it spoils during the day. Look, you can see we have nothing.
Like many unpermitted parks in the area, Valenzuela built up slowly, one mobile home at a time. Their old electrical system finally gave out, but county officials rejected a plan to restore power, saying other aspects of the site weren't up to code, and a lot of legal wrangling ensued.
To be honest, they wouldn't like to live the way we're living right now.
Resident Cerrito Ortega says the county offered them short-term housing subsidies to relocate. But here, he practically lives in the fields where he works. He makes under $200 a week and says he can't afford to commute to work. Ortega and his neighbors want power here, while the property owner works to get the whole park up to code with the county.
I understand politics, and I'm grateful they worry about our safety, but they're not concerned about our needs at this moment. Electricity is vital for the entire world.
Monica Tejas works for the county's Economic Development Department, and she knows people are frustrated. She says the county's working on reducing the often prohibitive fees and helping landowners bring parks to compliance. But she says,
just because it's operable doesn't mean that it's safe. And if someone is asking planning department, anybody to sign off on something that they do not know is safe, I don't know who would do that.
The real dilemma is, how do residents, advocates, and government agencies balance the need for housing to be up to code with the reality of people's living situations? In mid-April, Valenzuela residents heard that, after multiple inspections and calls from politicians, the county approved permits for temporary electricity to some of their mobile homes, if safety and long-term permitting plans are in place. They're hoping to get power back on soon. For the California Report, I'm Lisa Morehouse in the Eastern Coachella Valley.
For more of Lisa's reporting in rural California and to see pictures of her trip to the Eastern Coachella Valley, check out our website, californiareport.org. And that's the California Report, production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director is Susie Racho. The technical producer is Seal Mahler. Additional engineering from Howard Gelman. The online team includes Lisa Pickoff-White, David Marks, and Don Clyde. Thanks to our interns, Alex Emsley, Guy Marzorati, and Gina Shalaba. Our editorial team includes Victoria Maleon, Ingrid Becker, Julia McAvoy, Bruce Kuhn, and Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. And the California Endowment. Health happens in schools at calendow.org.